whoever you are, wherever you are, and whenever it is, you are catching some brainwaves coming to you from the banks of the seasoned and autumnal St. Vrain River in almost always sunny Longmont, Colorado. I'm Becky Peters, and across the table is the co-host who composes most of his work email in a combination of Comic Sans and emoji, and people still somehow love him. He's Ben Kalb. Ben, what's good?
I reply to that with a smiley face emoji, a party popper emoji, and a person triumphantly raising both hands in celebration emoji, Becky, because it's all good. We are having so much fun every other week, bringing giants in education to the earbuds of busy listeners so that we can all be more informed, inspired, and connected educators.
100% emoji back at you, Ben. And these giants in education have sound educational philosophy mixed with super tangible tips that we can put into practice right away. In our last episode, we spoke with Stanford professor and author Denise Pope, who had a brilliantly simple but powerful tip. When you give a test, put a blank table or box at the end of the test for students to show what they know. She talked about how impactful this can be to ease student stress because your test may not have asked the questions the kid was ready for, but they want you to know that at the same time they did try and that they do know the content, maybe just in a different way. And if we think back two episodes to John Hattie, to John Hattie's interview, think of how much a little entry like that could help us as teachers better understand our own impact and the growth and progress of our students.
Yeah, totally. And I think back to teaching and how much I wish I'd had a little box of show what you know at the end of tests. That would have been fantastic. And advice like that is why I love this podcast. And we have some more advice like that in just a few seconds, but we know some of our listeners like to skip right ahead to the interview. So if you want to get right to the interview with our most requested guest of all time, the educational powerhouse, George Kuros, his interview starts at the 7:15 mark. But otherwise, hey Siri, what time is it?
It's time to get out of our heads and into the classroom.
I need help!
Somebody please help me.
Help me!
Give me something I can use.
Let's get out of our heads and into that classroom.
Well, that's right. It's out of our heads into the classroom, the part of the show where we give you tangible tips and actionable advice that you can put into practice right away. And last week's episode, we dropped a tool called ClassroomScreen.com. It was a fan favorite, and it was so popular that friend of the podcast, Phil Gerner, actually used that tool to win a demo slam at a local ed camp. So the bar is very high, Becky. What do you got for us today?
Oh, man, I didn't know that. I love Phil. Good job, Phil. Way to win. So my first tangible tip, it's sort of a game. It actually comes from a website called GameStorming.com, which I will link in show notes, whose tagline is a toolkit for innovators, rule breakers, and change makers. It's actually a book, too. You can buy on Amazon, but they have a lot of free content on their blog, too. So I highly recommend it. But in any case, the game I want to share with you is called Atomize. And the idea is that you take a concept that you've learned as a class or in a group, put it on a sticky note, kind of at the top of like a wall or something. And then the way you play is by breaking that concept into the smallest atom components that you can. So first you split it into subconcepts, and then those subconcepts get subconcepts in, until you get all the way to the bottom to understand what the atoms are that make up that system. And at each stage, to get people to go deeper, you can ask things like, what combines to create this element? Because sometimes you think you're all the way at the bottom, but really there's more components to it. So what you might do is like, for the whole of algebra, you could start a class or even do kind of a midterm review, like what combines to create the concept algebra. You might get answers like equations, variables, lines, functions. So you can move the post-its around and talk about which levels those things belong at. And then you can go deeper. What combines to create functions? Well, you need patterns to create functions and so on. Or you could do it for an ecosystem like the rainforest. What combines to make the rainforest? And then talk about all the conditions, habitats, species that make the rainforest its own ecosystem. You could even do it for problem solving with culture. Say there's a bullying problem at your school, you could put bullying at the top and ask what exists that creates that culture and try to take it all the way down to the most atomic level, because that may just be where you can tweak and interrupt patterns and affect real change. It's also a really good tool for systemic thinking. You could even do it for like a school, the whole school district, to help people better understand all the different systems that go into running a district or a school or a classroom. It could be a really enlightening way to help people see the bigger picture, but then also the smaller conditions that create that picture.
Atomize. It's got bits of real science in it, so you know what's good. That is a fantastic tangible tip there, Becky. I really like it. And my tangible tip is also going to come from the book GameStorm, and it's all about co-creating a process checklist as a class. When I think back to my time as a student, I dutifully and compliantly memorized the steps in pretty much any process I did as a learner. I remembered the steps to solve a quadratic equation. I remembered the steps for writing a persuasive essay. But just because I'd compliantly memorized them didn't mean I actually understood. And Dan Meyer and tons of our other guests have really identified why knowledge isn't understanding and how those two things are different. And so how cool would it be if instead of dutifully memorizing steps, students co-create checklists? So I envision you as the teacher writing on the board, today we will be creating a checklist for blank, writing a persuasive essay, identifying the credibility of a website, solving a quadratic equation, whatever it might be. And then you break the students into groups and give them a stack of sticky notes, or give them their own Padlet if you wanted to do this on technology. And what makes it neat is it's going to require students to think and prioritize different tasks inside of a complex process. And now once students have tackled this and done this in small groups, you can bring it whole group and combine like sticky notes until you have a common group process for the whole class. So this isn't only going to help students understand a process more deeply, it's going to give you a really great understanding of what they get and what they don't get.
That's awesome. It actually reminds me of Atul Gawande. He's a doctor who writes articles for The New Yorker and other places, but he has this book called The Checklist Manifesto, and it's all about the life-saving attributes of checklists and how they're good for everyone from aircraft crews to surgical teams and how they help raise effectiveness and reduce error. And the three things that he says that they must be is concise, clear, and collaborative. So the co-creation technique that you mentioned is an important part of it. And as always, we love seeing how some of these tips and tricks are being used and actually manifest in the classroom. We love when our listeners share their learning via the hashtag #MakeSomeBrainwaves, so please share with us. And when it comes to sharing learning, literally no one does it better than our guest today, George Kuros. His best-selling book, The Innovator's Mindset, has a 4.9 rating on Amazon. He has hundreds of thousands of followers on Twitter and through his blog, including me, where he shares what he learns several times each day. I love reading those posts.
Yeah, and in this episode, we talk about what is innovation, how difficult questions can challenge our thinking, and why we shouldn't settle for just a growth mindset. So without further ado, here he is.
But I'm curious with our first question, what is an innovator's mindset, and to what problem is it the solution?
Oh, geez, you're starting off with this tough stuff right away. So the
Totally.
So basically, years ago, when I was a principal, we spent a lot of time looking at a growth mindset. I'm sure you're familiar with Carol Dweck's work. And there's like a lot of contention about this because I think a lot of people get bothered by the use of growth mindset because it's used kind of as a leverage to guilt people for not agreeing with them. Like, hey, if you don't agree with me, you don't have like a growth mindset. So you hear things like that. And basically, I think one of the things Carol Dweck talks about is that, you can have a growth mindset in different things. So for example, like I don't really have a growth mindset towards the notion of skydiving. Like there's nothing you can do that would actually like get me, saying like, oh, if I really put my mind to this, I can do this. I don't care. I don't want to do that. Right. And so I think that's part of it too, is that, toward different things, at certain levels. And so kind of the growth mindset is kind of the idea that, you believe that your abilities, intelligence, and talents can be developed. But I think that we have to make sure it's clarified that it's in different areas, right? It's not like you're either growth or fixed, right? Even people that a lot of people have deemed fixed mindset guarantee in some areas of their life or their profession are very growth oriented. Now, the notion of the innovator's mindset is kind of like a step further. And it is ultimately, I define it as the belief that abilities, intelligence, and talents are developed so they lead to the creation of new and better ideas. So, for example, just even this podcast, right? I'm sure you've heard podcasts and you're interested in doing this, but now you're actually, you're taking your knowledge and you're actually developing and creating something. And I think that's really kind of what we're trying to do. And I think that it's not just in education that this is important. It's, how we're looking at the world, and it's developing, people to not only, learn to develop. I think that in some ways, and this might be a little contentious, in some ways, I think that we use growth mindset and it's just a nicer way to say compliance. Like I'm going to, we want these kids to have a growth mindset because we want them to learn the math that we're forcing them to learn, as opposed to what are these kids actually doing with this math that they're developing and actually empowering them to kind of find their own way. And I think that's what we're trying to do, is that when we're looking at this notion of the innovator's mindset, how are we actually kind of putting, you know, the path and the direction of a child's growth and, you know, even an adult's growth to actually create and find their own way. And this is something that, you know, I'm really passionate about, obviously. And I think a lot of people are really gravitating towards this because there's a lot of people who know a lot of stuff who don't do anything with it. And I think that we're trying to go further than that.
That's so good. We did a whole, like Ben and I have talked a lot about that, like the knowing doing gap. And we have all these things that we know, but we aren't putting into action. And that's, I mean, basically when I read your book and even when I read your blogs, I get the emails that, you know, you've got a new one out and I love reading your stuff every day. But it just seems to me that the innovation takes it a step further. And you're right, it's about creation more than anything else. So I'd love to know, like, what are some examples before we get into like education, what are some examples of when you personally, George Kuros, have been really innovative in your life? And do you feel like you need to practice being creative and making and innovating?
This is like, I feel like this is like an intervention all of a sudden. So
that's why we brought you here today.
It's all a trap.
I think that actually one of the things that you kind of mentioned is my blog. Now, I've actually seen people for years actually, you know, blog and read, and like I find them really interesting. And to be honest with you, in some ways more interesting than books, because they're like short snippets, they give you some information. And I think that what I've done with my blog, and it'd be really, really interesting, because I don't even know if you know this, and you said you read my blog, like whenever it comes out, that it's actually, it's created as a portfolio that's aligned with the Alberta Principal Quality Standards. And so it's kind of hidden in there. But there's seven standards where and that's the thing, is that people don't even know. And so actually the whole reason I even started to write a blog in the first place was actually to understand how could this actually be used as a portfolio for student learning. And my thought was that if we're really going to be effective at this as educators, we really need to understand it from the viewpoint of a learner. So that's actually why I started doing what I was doing in the first place. And so I started creating this, but every time that I write something, I'm like, okay, where are these seven standards this is actually meet? And what I've done with this over time is we've actually started implementing this with students and how they would actually use this. And so they kind of have an understanding of their learning, how it applies to different areas and subjects of what they're teaching. And what we've actually focused on is actually moving this, that a kid would start this in kindergarten, but they would actually develop it all the way through grade 12, no matter class, subject, teacher, grade, school, anything. And they would actually create their own pathway. And so we didn't want it to be like, here's this template or here's the software and focus all on the software. We actually really wanted to focus on the student's learning. And I think that something that I'm proud of, and I know a lot of people mention, is that a lot of the stuff that I talk about, you know, for student learning and for what we can do in schools is not stuff that I focus solely on teaching, but really focus on understanding it as a learner. And I think that's one of the big shifts, is really immersing yourself in these experiences to have understanding. Because a lot of people, you know, you see this, you know, a lot of people talk about all the negative effects of technology, who use zero technology, and they don't talk about it. And so really, how do you understand it? And I think that part of the way that I look at, you know, research is not necessarily only seeing like how this impacts kids, but actually impacts learners, and being myself as the guinea pig for this whole process in what I'm doing. I think that taking that experience and trying to develop new and better ways for our students to actually have an understanding, it really starts with me focusing on learning first, not teaching.
That is fascinating. It explains a lot too about, because I had like three other questions written in my plan here about that. And like a lot of what you just said explain a lot of them away. So I might be redundant, but I'm curious about it mostly. Like, how do you live out there? How do you handle that? I mean, you put all of your thoughts out there for everybody to see. How do you do that while staying so clear to your own values and principles, but also maintaining to keep your perspective fresh and like being open to new ideas at the same time?
Well, to be honest, I have no idea if my perspective is fresh in the first place. I just put out my thoughts and see where it goes. And sometimes I think, going back to the blogging, and I don't want to be, you know, kind of beating this to death, but the idea that My blogging is sometimes I actually write and create to share my learning, but actually sometimes I do it to learn, if that makes sense. That I'm like, okay, I have this idea and I'm trying to work it out. And so what I'll do is I'll just start writing and start developing it, which I think is a really skill we don't actually teach kids, right? To actually write, to learn. And I think that's a big shift in thinking. And so I try to put those ideas out there, and you can kind of see, like, sometimes I put like an asterisk, like, hey, I am like working through this idea. So like, bear with me as I go. And I think that part of it too, is that when you put your ideas out there, this is, I talk about this idea of a 360 view of ideas. I always think about what is going to be the rebuttal against what I'm saying. What is going to be the attack on this? What is going to be the thing that people are going to say, well, what about this, this, and this? And so within my, because I'm putting it out there, I start addressing those things within the process, within the idea of writing. And I think that's something that when you put your ideas out there, you do have to be very cognizant before they even happen of the attacks or, you know, the complaints about what you're saying. And so you can actually, if you, now that you're listening to me and you're hearing how I explain it, you'll see how I actually debunk arguments within the stuff that I actually share. Because I already know what most of the many complaints are going to be, or, you know, pushback. And so I try to address that. And I think that blogging and sharing your ideas really helps that. And there's a really great quote, and I shared in my book, Clive Thompson. He said, anyone can win an argument inside their head, but when you have to face an audience, you have to be truly convincing. And so when you put that stuff out there within to an audience where anyone can see, you have to be very thoughtful of what are going to be different perspectives toward this. And I think that's a really valuable skill to teach kids.
Totally. Well, and Clive in his book, Smarter Than You Think, has that really cool story where he shows that when you actually produce for an audience, you think through the idea way better than if you're just doing it in your head. So I love that you practice what you preach. You talk in innovators' mindset about leaders needing to go first, and you do that with your blog. And I love that. I would love to spend some time now talking about that book. And one of the really powerful stories that I loved was the story of your Uber ride and what that taught you about the changing landscape of schools.
So one of the stories I share in the book is about an Uber experience I had, and Uber was really, really new, and it was not something that many people are using. To be honest, there wasn't as many drivers nowhere near to the point there are today, where you have like queues in airports and things like that. And so it was at the point where I was using it and it was new to me, but I was also comfortable with it, if that makes sense. So I actually was speaking at a conference in Roanoke, Virginia. And when I actually landed at the airport, I hit up Uber. And by the time I actually walked out, there's a gentleman who's standing outside and he's waiting for me already. He's got his trunk open. He grabs my stuff immediately. He like puts my stuff in the trunk. He opens the back door for me. I go sit there. And there's like bottled water in the back, and it's like, you know, amazing car service. It's like a Prius, but I can barely fit in it. But so whatever. And so then I actually, we're start driving away, and I'm just thinking like, this is like just the best car service I've ever had. And so as we're driving away, I said, sir, can you actually drop me off at this hotel? And he just totally ignored me. And I was like, wow, that's kind of weird. And then I said it again, he ignored me. And so I had to tap him on the shoulder, and he turned around. And then he said he was deaf. And I was so mortified and embarrassed, I had no clue. And we actually went to the hotel where, you know, I was speaking, and he dropped me off, and I actually could not stop thinking about this guy. And so the next day I spoke at the conference, and I had to actually go back to the airport. And so I actually hit up Uber, and the same guy picked me up, which, you know, like at the time, I think there's like one Uber driver in Virginia. Like, it's insane that I actually got the same guy. And so we're actually driving back, and it was just serendipity that about maybe 3 or 4 weeks earlier, I saw a picture on a site called Imgur, which is like my like stress relief website. It's just an awesome site that shares like goofy pictures and things like that. And I actually had someone who had a deaf Uber driver, and they actually went online and learned to sign thank you. And so they did it. And I was like, you know, I'm totally doing this. And so I actually went on my phone, went onto YouTube, and I actually learned to sign thank you. And so we got to the airport. And he puts my stuff on the curb, and I looked at him, I said, sir, thank you. And I actually signed thank you to him, and he started like actually tearing up, and I started bawling and hugged the guy for some reason. So it was just like a really weird moment. And so I always share that story, and I think about like all the things that I told in that story that didn't exist like 10, 15 years ago, you know, the access to, you know, like an abundance of information, you know, the ability to learn anytime, anywhere, you know, on your phone, just things like Uber and how those things are actually developing. And so I usually share that story with groups of educators because it's how are we actually taking advantage of all these new things in our world? And it shows you all the opportunities and advantages that we have right now. And that's why I love sharing that story. You know, like even the idea, like I would love to pretend, you know, I was like totally thinking of that. And it was like my original idea, but it wasn't. It was actually an idea I saw because I immersed myself and I look at all these different networks and I got the idea from someone else. I'm like, this is a perfect time to take advantage and utilize what I saw. So I think that's really one of the reasons that I love sharing that story is because it shows you, like, you could not tell that story 20 years ago, which I think is fascinating, right? It's a story that can only exist today.
So with that, then I'm going to blow it up a little bit. Like, so if, you know, the purpose of education, we've always, you know, the old model is to teach people facts and things that they can go out and then use so that they can be like factory workers and things like that. So with all these shifts and with all of these things, like stories that you couldn't have told 20 years ago, what do you, like, with all of your expertise and experiences, what do you think really the purpose of our education system is now or needs to be for like K-12 education?
Well, I think it's really kind of developing learners as like people and have the ability to think and create and create their own pathway. Like one of the things, I know this is going to sound super weird for someone who works directly with K-12 education, is that my number one goal is not for kids to actually go to post-secondary. That's not my focus. And I think that when, to be honest with you, when I was a kid, it was kind of taught to you that you either went to post-secondary or you're kind of deemed as a loser. And I think that that is like a really outdated and scary thing. And I think that's still the belief with a lot of adults that this is the way to a better life. Now, I'm not against kids going to post-secondary, but really what I want to help develop is that we actually help kids find a pathway. Like we have said this for years that a lot of our kids come out of school and they have no clue what they actually want to do. And is that in any way because we just kind of give them a little taste of this, a little taste of this, and almost, you know, confuse them more than we actually help them, you know, find a passion, develop it. Now, I'm not all about like, hey, let's find a passion and all that too, but I think it's really kind of helping kids find a pathway. There are so many kids who walk out of our schools who have no idea what they want to do, have no idea, more importantly, of what their strengths and what their abilities are. And I think that's what we're trying to do because it's much easier to be successful in, you know, like a career or work. If you actually are doing things that you're passionate about and you can actually develop your strengths, you're more likely to be innovative than actually just going to a place where you hate going every single day. Now, that on the other hand, it's not all about preparing kids for work. I don't think that's part of it too, but really thinking about, you know, how we are as people, how we develop, how we actually question and ideas and thoughts, and really not always having kids on the offensive and challenging things, but actually really teaching them how to think, not what to think. And I think this is something we're getting a little bit dangerous time in our world that we're kind of like, this is how kids think. And if they all think this way when they walk out, I think we're in trouble. But I think that kids asking questions, like I shared a tweet the other day and a teacher talked about, they tweeted back and I reshared it. And basically they have like totally flipped their classroom to the sense where they're not actually having kids, you know, find answers first, but they're actually developing questions. And she said it changed everything about her practice, is that they're really trying to figure out things that they're passionate about, you know, and it's not just developing questions and walking away from it, but actually developing these questions and then going find the answers. And I thought that was a really fascinating thing that she shared. And I think that's what we're trying to do, is get our kids, you know, to ask better questions, to really challenge a lot of things they see in the world. The idea that, you know, we're preparing kids for the jobs of tomorrow, I think is something that I'm not necessarily really passionate about. I think what I'm really more excited about is the idea of helping kids create the opportunities for tomorrow. And I think that's really a big shift for thinking, is that we always are trying to fit kids into somebody else's plans as opposed to helping them create their own. I don't know if that makes sense, or
it makes all the sense in the world.
Yeah, definitely. Well, and so in there, you mentioned a strength-based approach. And so can you talk to how you did that as a principal? You really focused on teacher strength, and then why that makes more sense than the deficit model that we see in a lot of our schools now?
Well, I think there's a big focus, first of all, on data-driven, which drives me insane. And I've written about how stupid that term is and how terrible the direction it's going. Now, when you talk about data-driven, often the equivalent is, if you really dig in deep, it's weakness-focused, that we are going to continuously find out where we're weak, and then we're going to hammer that home, and we're going to develop that. And I think that if you are in a place where you are continuously focused on your weaknesses and not what you're actually really strong at, I think that is demoralizing for one, but it doesn't actually bring out the best. And so really, I really talked about the notion of being learner-driven. And the reason I use the term learner-driven as opposed to student-driven is because students are the biggest part of our population, but they are actually only one part of it. Whereas learner-driven is really focused on all people. So like that we are developing learners, you know, as our support staff, our educators, and obviously also our students, but our community. And I think that it's the idea of how you actually find the strengths of the people that you work with and actually try to bring those things out and develop them. And so like a really an idea that was simple that, you know, I implemented when I was a principal was we actually had to identify like four target areas of things that we wanted to work in our schools. And what we usually do is like we'll bring in, you know, external speakers, and obviously like I think there's power in bringing in outsider perspective, obviously, because I do that for a living, because it gives you a different viewpoint on things. But also really, you can't just do that but not tap into the expertise and power of the people that are actually in your buildings. So instead of saying like, hey, you are weak in this area, you're going to go and get extra professional development on this, etc., we actually said, who are the people that are best in our organization in these areas? And I want you to go to the place that is really important to you, which is what you're really passionate about. And so we didn't say like there has to be equal groups or whatever. So we had like a really large group or a really small group, whatever. But the teachers and the staff on my staff were actually the ones who were leading the professional learning in those four areas. So even though they were kind of deemed as weaknesses of our school district and things we had to develop, they were led by the people who were actually strongest. And it kind of got rid of the notion of you can't be a prophet in your own land. It actually showed that, you know, there's expertise right in our buildings right now. And that if we need help, that we can actually walk across the hallway, not, you know, contact someone across the world. And I think that's a real big shift. And why I wanted to do that is really kind of focusing on how do we actually do that with our students, where we develop them that way. And the example that I use quite a bit is the idea of response to intervention meetings. Like we do this about, you know, students who struggle. And basically what we do is, and I'm not saying all people do this, but I've seen this as a common practice, is that we will figure out, you know, find the students who are struggling academically, et cetera, et cetera. And then we will talk about all of their weaknesses, and then we will plan strategies on actually how to fix those weaknesses. And I want you to really think about, if you were working in an organization where all I did was focus on what you're weak at and how it's going to fix you, how excited you would be to come to work every day. And so what I've really encouraged people to really shift their thinking on that is that, yeah, we understand students struggle, but the first thing you should be talking about is, what are these kids really good at? Like, what's getting them excited to get into the door every single day? And actually how you develop that, and actually how you leverage and utilize that. And so like a really easy example for me as a kid, well, I hated reading, but I loved basketball. So is there any way you could have actually foregone, you know, the Great Gatsby and all these other things and actually got me read stuff like where, you know, sports related or nonfiction other than textbooks? Because that would have actually helped me develop that. And I think that when you focus on the strengths, you actually develop your weaknesses. It's not about ignoring them. It's actually starting at just at a different point. And I think that's a really big shift for people, because we're always trying to fix people in education as opposed to develop them and build on those strengths, understanding their weaknesses will develop. Now, I made a comment, you know, about how much I hate the term data-driven. And I think that one of the things that I really try to differentiate, I'm not against data at all, but I'm against being driven by it. I think that's what we've done a lot of times. We've taken like this really human profession, and we so focused on the score that in pursuit of getting a score, we actually lose kids along the way, as opposed to developing these people. And instead of using the term data, I've really encouraged people to use evidence, because evidence is the idea, you know, it's not just tests, it's not just scores, but it's like interaction with the hallway. Like it's developing, you know, kids as people. Like one of the things that I was told as a kid over and over again, it was a constant complaint, was that I talk too much, and now I talk for a living. And so why was that never actually, you know, given, you know, seen as a strength for me? And so I really, you know, really try to get people to shift from this note of data driven to evidence informed, learner driven. Because if you focus on the learner, I think that I'm not really concerned that the scores are going to go down if you really focus on actually developing these people. I actually think if anything, the scores will go up. But I think that we have kids who might be really good at doing a test, but actually can't think. And I think that's a big issue. And so I think that all the stuff that we're doing within our schools, what is often really good practice for the adults is also good practice for the students. And I think that when we model that through, you know, the way we lead our schools, the way we do our work, then we have a much better understanding, as I kind of shared earlier, you know, from the viewpoint of a learner, not simply as, you know, someone just, you know, disseminating information.
A lot of what you just spoke about I kept coming back to your, like, I don't know if you call it a rubric or not, but the compliance to engagement to empowerment. Can you talk a little bit about where that came from and like why you think it's so important that teachers and then possibly like students too keep an eye on those things and make sure that they're getting the opportunity to be empowered in their classroom?
Yeah, so actually I wrote about this in the book, but I also kind of shared a visual of it talking about, you know, kind of shifting from compliance engagement to empowerment. And I think what's really important to understand is that it's not about like you're either empowered or you're compliant. Like it's not a one or the other. That again, simply like, you know, like as we started talking about the growth mindset in the first place, is that in different areas, there's different needs. So for example, every single year, I have to do my taxes. And so the IRS isn't going to be really excited if I said, hey, you know what? I try to do this PowerPoint to present my taxes this year. Like, you know, I have to do it in a certain way and get it done at a certain time. So there actually is a lot of things that we have to do, you know, we have to be compliant about. And I think it's not about ridding our schools of compliance. There is a part of that too. But I think it's really, schools can't just be about compliance. And I think it's when we find those times for our students to go beyond even the idea of engagement, but empowerment, because I think this is the easiest way, and I explain this to people all the time, is that people always challenge me, like, well, isn't engagement important in our world anymore? I'm like, well, no, but here's the easiest way I can explain this, is that you can be engaged, but it doesn't mean you're empowered. But I guarantee if you're empowered, you're engaged, but now you have much more ownership over the process, and you're actually, you know, kind of developing your own pathway. And I think that's what we're trying to shift to, is that where do we have our students where they have ownership over their learning? And one of the examples, you know, my best boss ever, I was in charge of technology in our school and in the role of a teacher. And one year she brought me in and said, hey, we have this amount of money. I want you to kind of go through it. And I want you to tell me all of the things that you believe we should be getting with this budget. Even though I was a teacher, I was not an admin at this point. And I was like, well, that's not really like what I'm supposed to do, right? Like I'm supposed to like help with the integration and all that other stuff. And she, I remember saying to me, she's like, we brought you in here because you have an expertise in this and I don't. And so because you have an expertise in this, why would I make the decisions and then just kind of give over the ideas to you, or, you know, and then make them happen based on things that I don't even really understand. And I'll tell you that when I had to actually really go through and say, okay, now I actually have like ownership over this process, I thought about it way more than I ever did. And it's pretty easy to complain, well, the men did this and that and that. You know, but now I was terrified of those complaints because I was actually the one who was making the decisions. And I think she understood that through that process, is that because I had ownership over this, there's going to be a lot more thought into it. It wasn't just me doing something, you know, based on her bidding. It was actually, I was part of the solution. And that actually gave me much more ownership over the school and the direction of the school, even from the path, even as the role of a teacher. And I think that's what we're trying to do with our students is get them to understand, you know, how they have, you know, much more influence in our schools and to kind of develop that through this process. And I think that's a big shift. It's not they're just showing up and we're giving them really engaging activities that they find interesting, but they're actually finding their own way. And I think that ties in beautifully to the notion of the innovator's mindset is that it's going beyond simply, I can learn this to like, I'm going to create something with what I know. I think that's where the big shift is.
Yeah. And yeah, you're so right that I'm engaged by a lot of YouTube videos.
Absolutely.
But that's way different than empowering. And what you said about compliance makes sense why I got audited for my stop motion tax return. That didn't work too well. So, that makes sense. So I was wondering if you ever run out of mics to drop, because your book is just absolutely full of mic drop moments. One of them that I loved is the quote, change never fails because it happens too early. And you talk about like Blockbuster going out of business. And I'm curious what you think is the Blockbuster, the change that is coming in education, the thing that we need to just get on board and go with.
I always get asked this question, like, what do you see as the next big thing? And my answer is, I have no idea. I honestly have no idea, because like, I didn't predict the internet. I didn't predict iPads. I didn't predict, you know, Chromebooks and all these things that we're seeing come into the classroom. And, you know, all these technologies that are really altering and changing a lot of things that we can actually do, but we're often using them in the same way. And what I tell people is that it doesn't matter. What really is important is that no matter what comes our way, well, not only will we figure it out, we'll actually thrive using this. And I think that's why one of the things I really tried to do when writing the book was to make sure that it was applicable, you know, 20, 30, 40 years from now, and really talk about our thinking more than stuff. And I think that's what we're trying to do. I'll be honest with you that I probably see in about 300-400 schools every year, just, you know, not like as a principal, you know, there every single day in that one school, but I see so many different schools. I see so many different things. And one of the things that I've really noticed is probably in the last 5 years, this huge shift that's actually happening in education, where it's really much more learner focused. It's much more talking about empowering, you know, ideas. It's about kids actually creating solutions, you know, for their problems. And a lot of the things that I'm talking about in the book, and in no way am I saying, well, because my book came out, look at all these things are happening. I'm not connecting the two at all. But the way that I'm seeing things, I'm seeing this huge shift. And I think really the shift has come because we have so much better access to one another. And I think that other schools are seeing what other schools are doing, and they're going like, hey, like, they're doing this. They're not, you know, they don't have a ton of funds. They have the same structure we do. Why can't we do this? And they're starting to create their own pathways, but there's no ideas that are actually being really carbon copied. There's ideas that are being taken and used, but they're always, like, a lot of teachers are actually creating them in their own ways. And so I think that really, no matter what comes our way, the focus is how do we actually create it and develop this in a way that we're actually going to thrive, not just adapt to this. It's hard to talk about innovation and technology because they're two separate things. But I think that one of the things that people who have traditionally really been good with technology, I think in many ways, they are really great innovators in some contexts, because they always have to learn new things. That even if you use the same software for 10 years, that software is going to change over and over and over again. And they're always adapting and they're changing this. And I think that's one of the skills. But now, because technology, people use technology with such a small percentage of people before, but now it's becoming bigger and bigger because, let's be honest, technology is a lot easier to use than it once was. Like, what I used to do, I would actually think that in many ways, like, I was better with a computer when I was a kid using an Apple IIc and like learning how to program things, because really there wasn't that much you could do with an Apple IIc compared to what you can do with a computer now, you know, because everything's kind of set up for you. I think that we're seeing more and more people becoming more and more comfortable with change and actually figuring out new ways and actually how they're utilizing it. Like, even just the notion of Twitter, a lot of educators went on there and they started using it in a totally different way than was intended by the people who created Twitter in the first place, right? It was just kind of Facebook status updates, and now people are sharing ideas and connecting. And I think that it wasn't people just went in and learned how to use Twitter. It's people actually went in and learned how to use it and started leveraging it to their advantage so that they could actually become better at their work. And I think that mindset is what is so crucial. It's not simply, hey, this will come and here's this new thing. There's going to be new technologies. There's always been new technologies. There's always going to be new ideas, but it's really kind of shifting our thinking that's going to be most important.
I'm going to ask Ben's question in a slightly different way, just because I'm curious about it. With your blog posts, like, what are some of, like, one of the most, like, popular that everybody's like, yes, yes, George, that's amazing insight. And then what is one of the posts that you've had like the most pushback on? I'm just curious how people respond to different things and like how that gives you a pulse on what educators are thinking.
Well, a lot of times, honestly, just kind of focusing on the importance of relationships. Obviously, like, I kind of wrote a series on like just really easy, quick ways that you can actually, you know, develop classroom culture, school culture, and school district culture. And I think those are obviously, you know, and I don't know if they're like groundbreaking ideas, but they're maybe like quick digestible things. And a lot of times when I share these ideas, the hope is that it's not like, hey, here's 10 things and these are the only 10 things. And if you just do these 10 things and that's it. The hope is that people say, well, yeah, we do this, we do this, we do this. And people actually contribute and actually share those ideas. And I think that is, that's something I always will focus on. And like, I'm obviously really big on innovation, but I'm also very big on relationships because I actually see them as crucial to innovation. That if a person feels valued and shows up to school every day and they're excited about what they're doing, they are way more likely to be innovative than they are if they hate where they're going. And I think people don't see them as a connection. And I think that's where we're losing people, that we can say this like, oh, innovation. But like, I got an email from a staff member that I talked at their school recently, and they talked about how basically their district, you know, bought my book for everybody. They focus on innovation, but then they like have to like observe them doing their meetings and all this other stuff. And it was like super micromanaging. And they're like saying all these things, but they don't actually practice this. And I think that's, you know, if you read any Stephen Covey stuff talking about Suite of Trust. And so really I talk a lot about relationships and I kind of try to intertwine them. Now, this is kind of, I'm sure this will not surprise you at all, but one of the blog posts that I got a lot of pushback on, and it wasn't actually from educators, it was just from people outside education, was talking about cursive handwriting, which I thought was really fascinating.
It's contentious stuff, man.
Well, it is, and it's really interesting because I actually didn't really make a statement on it, which was kind of the point, right? And so I kind of said, like, you know, here's some of the arguments for it and why it's actually so important to teach, and then here's some of the reasons why this is like something that we have to like rethink. I didn't say something to get rid of. And I think that even if you even mention it, people freak out about this stuff, right? Like, you know, we talk cursive handwriting. When I obviously learned cursive handwriting based on my age and when I went to school. And I guarantee you, people were not talking about metacognition with it, right? It was just a skill to learn. But now it's like, oh, it's all about metacognition and all these other things. And that's great. But I think there's other ways you can actually develop, you know, those skills beyond cursive writing. But I think that one of the things that I always challenge people is that, like, I went to the school in the 80s. Like, my brother went to school in the 70s. I know people that teach that went in the schools in the 60s and 50s, people in the 90s. But the thing is that it doesn't matter when you went to school. The basic time frame of the school day is almost exactly the same. But the demand and what we're trying to teach is actually continuously increasing. And so that means that some stuff kind of has to go, or we have to teach it less. I think that's one of the things that we're talking about. And is it we teach that because there's a certain nostalgia to it? Like, you see people, like, no one, you know, said, you know what, this person that applied here is like super creative. They have all these really great ideas, but man, they're cursive handwriting. We can't help it. You know? But and you're having these people that, you know, they're stuck on, this is what I've learned and look at who I've become. And so obviously that is the formula. And I think that that's not always true. And one of the things that I always say to people and when I work with groups is there is this notion that parents want school to be the exact same way it was for them, which is not true at all. It's a totally, it's like, that's a sellout statement that we make as educators when we say that. What parents want for their kids is what they believe is best. And if they only know their experience of school, then they're going to assume that's the best because, you know, they've obviously turned out to be good people. They're about families, you know, I'm sure they're successful and whatever. And so one of the things that we used to do in our school is that we wouldn't just say like, hey, we're going to start doing this with the kids. We'd say, hey, we're going to, here's some things we're trying with your kids. And we're going to actually have a night where you can actually all participate and be a part of it so you can understand what it looks like. And when our parents would walk out of our classrooms, they'd be like, this is so much better than when I went to school. This is so great for a kid. And then we wouldn't get arguments about it because they would actually experience it. And I think that's one of the shifts. Like if you look at all these skills that kids are developing, if parents actually like were not only just understood it, but actually immersed in it, I think that you'd have a lot of changed minds and seeing how we're using our time differently. Now, like anyone who's listening to this right now, if like, man, is this guy against cursive? And that's not what I'm saying at all. The whole point of this is we have to really think differently and saying like, what is, you know, what is crucial? What is going to be needed years and years from now? Like, there's so much stuff. Like if we're being truly honest, there's a lot of great stuff that I learned in school that's helped me today, but there's probably way more stuff that I don't utilize at all. And I think that's something that we have to understand is that what is going to be actually crucial for our kids, not only right now, but as they move ahead in the future. And I think that's probably why I got so much pushback to it, because there is nostalgia about our childhood and about our experience of school, because we see ourselves as the evidence of the success of that. But in reality, that we grew up in a very different time. I think what's really important is I keep coming back to this notion is how we think and what we create with the solutions. That's one of the big shifts and probably why I got so much pushback to that. But that was years ago. Every year I get called from some like TV news station that wants to get in a cursive debate.
You're serious? Because of that. That's horrible. Year.
Wow. Yeah. I would have guessed it was your quote, in our world today, what is a kid more likely to need to be able to do, write an essay or a blog post? What's a more important skill, a hyperlink or an MLA citation? Have you gotten a lot of kickback with that?
Well, see, the thing is that when I ask those questions, I don't really give an answer. And I think that's why I don't get much pushback.
Yeah.
Because the whole point of the question is to get people to think.
Make us think. Yeah.
That's the whole point, right? It's because I always ask, I do workshops and I'll bring up that question and I'll ask English teachers specifically. And a lot of times it's like, well, blog, I guess, which is like, right? They're like mad at me, right?
I know what
right
you're looking right. for. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm like, well, no, I'm like, don't say what you think I think. Say what you think. And they're like, well, you know, I think there's really important elements of writing an essay. I said, well, do you think of blog? She's like, yeah, absolutely. And I said, okay. So actually my answer is both. That is my actual answer. And then I'll say, and they're like, well, I totally agree with that. I'm like, do you teach both? And I'm like, oh, I can't really do it.
Yeah.
And that's the whole point, right? Is that, you know, how I write a blog and how I used to write papers for, you know, like I'll tell you want a really unpopular blog? Let me publish my old, you know, academic papers from when I went to university, right? No one would read that. But you wouldn't be
touring the world if you did that, would you?
Yeah, the way we write, you know, the way we write blogs. And hey, that's maybe, you know, maybe it's because that was not my thing. But I think that there is a way that we communicate that's a little bit different in blogs. Like, you know, like I would use a smiley face in a blog post. I would never use it in an academic paper. And I think that shift in literacy actually is compelling to some people. And I think it's really powerful that, and I talk about how like this really little thing is that I was asked before I became a principal, if I would have put an emoticon in a staff or in an email to staff. I'm like, absolutely not. Like, I don't want to be deemed unprofessional that, you know, I'm like this new generation and like doing all these weird things. And then the first week that I was a principal, I actually had a staff member like come to my office and they were like so mad about an email I sent. I was like, what is going on? They're like, the tone of your email is like super angry. I'm like, hey, it is not that at all. I don't know what you're talking about. So next email I went, I was like, da 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 da, smiley face. And so I put that in there.
Bitmoji. Yeah.
And I'll tell you, that smiley face saved me so much time. Like so much time and so many emails. And we don't talk about that because we, you know, all these kids these days. No, well, we use them too. And I think that, you know, when I say that, a lot of, when I'm telling that story and I first start telling it, you can see a lot of principals like, oh my God, I like totally write like smiley faces in my email. And like, this guy is like saying how unprofessional it is. And then I shift it to saying it actually, yeah, it's not like, you know, I wouldn't put it in a cover letter. Like, hey, I'd love to work for you, smiley face. But the
monkey face.
Yeah.
Creepy.
I think so creepy. That it actually sets a different tone in your email in a time where, you know, like when so much communication is going out online, that in it is can be read in so many different ways. It actually is a tool to help, you know, convey a message. And I think that's the big point, is that we have to get kids to understand, because I'm not against an essay writing at all. I think there's so many powerful elements, things that I learned in school when I was a kid that have actually benefited the way that I write today. But there's also things that I learned after school that never were taught to me in class, and I had to figure that out on my own. And some people don't know if they have their permission to go figure this stuff out on their own, but they do, obviously. And I had developed that. We want to make school more purposeful so that we can, you know, create those opportunities so kids can have actually access to both. Because it's way more likely a kid's going to blog, you know, when they're done with school than it is they're going to continue writing essays for fun. So I think that's and obviously, like, there's careers that are made out of this. There's people doing this now. Some people obviously become professional writers, and that's a totally different thing. But I just think there's way more access to create this. And I think that's the whole purpose of the question. The purpose of the question, which is, I think, really interesting when I ask that, is to kind of tick people off a little bit, like to get people mad and bothered by it. And then they start like, well, I'll show him, and then they start doing it. I think that's kind of the shit, yeah. Right? Like, as you kind of want some, like, I'm sure that if you read my blog or you see me speak, I prod people and I poke them a little bit, because I want them to, I think that's where that discomfort is, where a lot of new learning comes from. And it's done in a way to support kids. It's not done in a way to tear down teachers. It's done in a way like, hey, like, have you thought about this and how this, you know, affects kids? And I think that when people understand how important that is to me, and that I'm on their side, then they understand why the poking and prodding is kind of important.
Yeah, 100%. Mm-hmm. Well, I guilted you into this podcast interview by talking about you being the highlight over my wife having a baby. And I said 30 minutes and we're at 48. So we definitely need to respect your time and let you run. But where can our listeners go to keep learning from and with you?
So you can follow me on Twitter at G Carose. And you don't even have to follow me there. I'd be honored if you did, but you can definitely reach out and mention or connect with me there if you have questions or anything about anything I said. My blog, obviously, georgecarose.ca. You can find a lot of my thinking there. And my book, The Innovator's Mindset, which actually, I know that we talked about this before, how both of you read my book. One of the really interesting things that tied into, I actually wrote that book in 2 weeks, and which is,
you pulled a lot from your blog, right?
Right. And that's why.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the things that I actually had never had an intention to write a book. And the reason why I could write in 2 weeks is because I actually immersed myself as a learner and basically built this library at the time that was like 6 or 7 years of information that I could actually pull from and put into a book form. And I think that's what we're trying to do with our students, is, you know, like seeing the long-term impact of like creating those type of things, how that could actually benefit them over time. And like I said earlier, one of the, like, I always feel uncomfortable when anyone like, you know, refers to me as an expert in anything. That's not something I would ever deem myself. But I am a really curious learner. And I think that, that's where I'm shifting. And so because of that, there are so many places you can find me sharing my learning and having them understand, like trying to develop this. I can figure these things out as you go along to support our staff and our students.
That's so cool too, because I know you spread that around like wildfire. Because we talked to Katie Martin not too long ago. She was one of our episodes in season one, and she said that you were the one that pushed her to write a book from her blog posts, and hers is amazing. And like, it's just I love how
I pushed her to blog too. I actually pushed her to blog.
Yeah, totally.
I was sitting in her office and listening to her. I'm like, do you blog? She's like, no, I'm like, you need to start blogging like right now.
So cute.
And then I like, and then people know this about me. Like if I, like, I won't stop until you start doing it. Cause I'm sure that when people listen to Katie, she's brilliant. And I'm sitting there, I'm like, this is not fair that I'm sitting in this room and I get access to this brilliance and so many people are not. And I think that it will not only benefit, to be honest with you, it will not only benefit all the people that get, you know, access to Katie's wisdom. It's going to impact Katie in a very positive way because she's going to have to really refine and think about her ideas because she's going to start putting them out there. And I think that knowing and being a part of that journey has been quite an honor. She's a very good friend of mine and we do a lot of conversations, a lot of work together. So it's great that so many people have access to her.
Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah, I'm glad you pushed.
I binged your podcast. Yeah, you guys have a podcast too.
Yeah,
that I don't know if it's been updated in a while.
We don't have seasons. We don't have seasons. We're just like, hey, what are you doing today?
You'll get that someday. You'll get that. Okay, you'll get
that. George, thank you so much for
taking
the time.
Can't thank you enough, man.
So if you didn't know before, now you know why he was our most requested guest of all time. Let's close up shop. Becky, what did you learn?
I had no idea that his blog was a reflection on the Canadian learning standards and also an experiment for how digital portfolios might work for his students. I thought that was really cool and really brave. I often wonder and really kind of kick myself for how much more I'd remember and synthesize and process if I actually took the time to reflect and write like he does. It's something we always encourage our students to do, but I don't take near enough time to do that myself. So personal resolution time, I need to make a plan to reflect more often. And since I'm saying it out loud to thousands of listeners, I now have to make it happen. Audience effect, right? And I can't believe I just got to say that we have thousands of listeners. This is the most fun I've ever had. How about you, Ben? What's your takeaway?
Yeah, definitely. I loved just his whole guinea pig mentality throughout the book and then through his actual life. There's a quote in the book that says, if we want to do things better for students, we have to become the guinea pigs and immerse ourselves in new learning opportunities to understand how to create the necessary change. We rarely create something different until we experience something different ourselves. So impressed with the fact that he doesn't just say that, but he does it, and it makes me want to do it too.
Cool. So let's go out this week and be marigold-colored guinea pigs. If you liked this episode, please share it with a friend and have a great generic time of day.